Welcome to the Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and today we have with us a really unique man that's done some quite controversial work, though I happen to believe that it's true. Greg, are you a doctor?
I'm not Dr. Greg Braden.
So just
you can
Greg
just call
Braden,
me Greg.
The one and only. Greg wrote the God Code, among other things, and that's pretty much what we're going to talk about tonight, in addition to this consciousness project that we're working on. The listeners are pretty familiar with that because we've been doing this every week with a different person.
Okay.
So tell us just a little bit about you, Greg, before we get started, so they'll know who you are, where they can get look at your work, your website, how they can contact you if they want to order something from you.
I thought you were going to do all that.
No, that's your job. On my show.
No, I'm this is the 20th year we've offered this work in one form or another, bridging, I believe, uniquely bridging science and spirituality. My background's in the hard sciences. My degrees are in ocean and information and earth sciences. And I was a senior computer systems designer for Martin Marietta Aerospace up through the end of the Cold War, and it was during that time that the seeds were planted for many of the projects, including the God Code that we'll talk about tonight. So we've covered a lot of ground since that time. I live in the high desert in northern New Mexico, is where home is right now, and we spend a tremendous amount of time going into some of the most ancient and remote and isolated and beautiful, magnificent, pristine places left on the earth today, researching records and ancient texts from those who have come before us who had a very empowering way of looking at the world and marrying that with the best science of our time today, hopefully help us to become better people and create a better world in a very difficult time in human and earth history.
Now, you have discovered something that's quite unique that you believe is in every single thing that exists that has consciousness. Am I right?
You're referencing the God Code?
Yes.
It is. It was in the last years of the Cold War when I was working again in the Defense Department in the aerospace industry. During for those listeners that may remember the Cold War, it was a very different kind of war. You didn't hear a lot about it in the front page of the headlines like you did Vietnam and Iraq on the one hand. And on the other hand, it was the first time in recorded human history that we came unthinkably close to unleashing the power of the atom in a way that is just it just defies the sensibilities in a war, a nuclear war that was believed to be survivable during
that
time.
Now, a lot of people don't believe that in itself, so tell us how you know that.
How we know what?
That we came that close in that manner. A lot of people think that that's just talk around the world.
Well, it's very well documented. The superpowers, United States, Soviet Union, had over 70,000 nuclear weapons that were prepared to use in battle. If it came to that, then the idea was that they were used as a deterrent. Each one believed that the other one had weapons that they couldn't match, and that was the premise that was called MADD, mutual assured destruction and deterrence. What we know is that through Cuba, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the order was actually given to launch against the United States during that time, and we know that at least two other times the orders were given and the technology failed for reasons that may make sense after we finish this conversation tonight.
What kind of technology was it? Was it scalar?
No, the technology, the weapons technology at that time, when people pushed a button, something's supposed to happen and it didn't, and we now know that electronics are very much attuned to human consciousness,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And very precise kinds of human consciousness, and it may answer be the answer to some of the things we're going to talk about tonight.
You know, it'd be really interesting to go back if Dean Radin's random event generators were working at that time and look at those printouts.
It'd be fascinating. I know Dean put those into effect in 1998, and they're still working very well today. And it was, for listeners that may not be familiar with Dean Radin's work, it was the first time that we've actually found certain kinds of electronics respond to changes in mass human consciousness. So 40 devices called eggs, EGGS, 40 little eggs were planted in continents all over the world, all reporting back to a single computer, a single server at Princeton University, measuring fluctuations in human consciousness. And during an average day when everybody's going about their business, they're just kind of a low-level hum that's coming out on this screen. And when something happens that commands our attention and consciousness is focused on a moment in time, that shows up as a blip, a glitch on the screen. And although Dean and Roger Nelson and the other scientists that developed this, although they're the first to acknowledge we do not know precisely why it's being measured the way it's being measured, what it shows is that there is something out there to be measured. And it's one of the first times that scientifically been able to document changes in mass human consciousness. Mm-hmm. So the GCP, Global Consciousness Project, is a big part of that.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to answer your question. It was during my time working behind the scenes in the Cold War, and I'll just preface this. I'm going to say that my personal belief is that we are an intentional species. I believe we're here on purpose. I don't know necessarily why or how or who has put us here. I just believe that scientifically the evidence strongly suggests that we're no fluke of biology, and we're no accident of DNA. There's an intentionality underlying our existence. So my thinking as an engineer was, if that was true, if we are in fact an intentional species, then it would make perfect sense that who or whatever is responsible for us being here would have left a message coded somewhere in our lives and our world that would tell us we're here on purpose. And if we could find that, perhaps, just perhaps, we could find a reason to work beyond the differences that led to the great wars of our past, including the wars of the 20th century and the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
If we could find that, and that led to a research project that's ongoing, even if it's not finished yet.
With who, you or someone else?
I am the one that began this project, and I've had to enlist the help and the services of many people who are experts in fields that I understand enough to work in. I'm not an expert in those fields, such as ancient languages, such as genetics, such as biology.
Mm-hmm.
And what the project allowed us to do, I'll just cut to the chase, the bottom line, is that by following the clues that we found in 5,000-year-old temples and texts and marrying those clues with the best science of today, so we married our two ways of knowing, science and spirituality, into a greater wisdom, we were literally able to translate the DNA of all life, the DNA in the cells of humans and a blade of grass, hamsters, dogs, goldfish, every form of life that we know that's called carbon-based life. We were able to translate that DNA into the letters of ancient alphabets. And when we began to do that, lo and behold, the DNA, that's always been called, by the way, the language of life.
Mm-hmm.
The DNA began to spell letters and words and sentences, and they began to make sense.
Now, is that the Hebrew alphabet?
Well, what happened was we were able to translate, convert the DNA of all life into numbers, and from those numbers, we were able to link those numbers to ancient, what are called root or core alphabets. Ancient Hebrew was the first one that we use because it lends itself to this. It's people that study the Kabbalah are very familiar with this. However, it also works in ancient Arabic. It also works in ancient Sanskrit. It appears to work in a number of other alphabets. Those are the three that we've looked at so far. But the bottom line is that this translation allowed us to look at DNA instead of the sticky, gooey, protoplasmic stuff that gives us life. All of a sudden, DNA becomes a message, and it becomes a message that we all carry in our bodies, no matter what our beliefs or our borders or our
mm-hmm.
bloodlines or our history. We're all carrying the same message, and the message is encoded in layers in our bodies, and each layer has a different code to translate that layer, and we took 12 years to translate this first layer, and the first layer is akin to the introduction into a book. It tells us what the rest of the DNA is going to say. And the first layer, I'll just share it with our listeners. Literally, when we translate the first letter, the first layer of the DNA of all life, it literally translates into the English words, God eternal within the body. God eternal within the body. It says it again and again and again. It doesn't say who God is or where God came from, but it literally says the name of God that we find in 2,000-year-old scrolls is encoded right there in the DNA of all life.
Now, does it use the word God, or is it another word?
It is the word for God and the word for eternal that we find in the 2,000-year-old scrolls. It's actually the personal name of God, literally spelled in the Hebrew alphabet as the letters YHVH.
Mm-hmm.
Yud Hey Vav Hey. I know some of our listeners are familiar with that. That literally translates in English, when you're translating from Hebrew to English, it translates into the words God or eternal. So this is one piece of a much a broader project to help us understand who we are in the world, who we are in life, and who we are in the universe. And what this tells us, Eva, a number of things. First of all, if there's a message in our DNA, it means we're here on purpose. It means that we are no accident. And it means, number two, that all life that has the same message in their DNA has a common heritage. If we find, you know, if we find life on Mars, or we find life, you know, in a crater of the moon, it might be in a different place, but if the DNA reads the same, it means we're all connected somewhere in the past.
I guess to me, it also infers that there is one source.
Well, and this is the third piece. What it says is that because that message exists, and it's not a theory, it now is a fact, we don't know why it's there. We know that when we follow those clues using the best science of our time, that the message is there. And because that message is found even in the most ancient and single-celled forms of life, it means that who or whatever put that message there is a greater intelligence that existed before those single-celled forms of life. So it means that we are connected to a greater source. At the very least, the message, we know that the message says those three things. So the project began in 1986. We had a little breakthrough in 2001. The book was published in 2004. We'll have the television and the media specials be coming out this next year. And this is one piece, as I mentioned, of a greater research project. So
what
if I
is
could,
that project? Is
well, if I
name?
Could describe that, and it will, I think it will help to understand why this is so important. We have a new book coming out at the end of this year. It's called The Divine Matrix, is the title of the book.
Mm-hmm.
What we now know, what Western scientists have the understanding they've arrived at here in the first years of the 21st century, it's the same thing that the spiritual traditions have been telling us for over 4,000 years now. Western scientists now acknowledge, and they have found under laboratory conditions, the evidence that we are bathed and permeated with a field of intelligent energy that connects everything in creation. There's a field of intelligence.
Do you think that field is by chance a zero-point field? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, where we run into problems, Eva, and this is why the scientists that you've mentioned before we began this program, you and I had a couple of moments to speak, and so many different people have different ideas about how to define consciousness. My opinion is the reason there's so many differences is because we are separating ourselves from that consciousness. From the perspective of the new physics discoveries and what the ancients were saying, everything is consciousness. You'd be hard-pressed to find anything that is not consciousness. And by virtue of that, because we're part of consciousness, that's what allows us to create changes in our world and in our bodies, because we're part of rather than separate from all that we see. The zero-point field is an expression of that consciousness. It's not that consciousness in its entirety. So you could... This field that has been discovered and acknowledged that seems so new to scientists, it's a field that was described and accepted by ancient indigenous traditions. And this is what's so interesting. We go we go into the villages in the mountains of Peru. These tiny villages are. We've just come back from almost 40 days in Tibet. It's the fourth trip into the monasteries. 12 monasteries and two nunneries during that period of time. And the teachings from these indigenous people, even right here in my own backyard in the desert southwest, their teachings begin where science has just arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Their teachings begin with the understanding. It's a given that everything is connected through this field of energy, and scientists are now saying, hey, guess what? You know, there's this field and we're connected. So scientists are excited. They're not sure what to do with the discovery. They're excited that the discovery was there.
What do you think the field is? I have an opinion that I think, you know, that we live in a hologram. And so
well, that's
far,
one way of describing it. The field is the essence. It is the quantum soup that underlies all existence. Everything that you will ever experience or imagine or know to be true in your life is an expression of this field. The field is the quantum soup that holds all possibilities.
Do you have I've been asking every one of these scientists, what do you think this field is composed of? Do you think it's the black matter?
Well, this. Let me.
Do you think it's electromagnetic? What do you think it is?
Well, let me finish the. The last thought, and then it may lay the foundation so that we can make sense of what that's saying. If this field of intelligence, by the way, the field is so new that scientists have yet to arrive at one name to give this field. So they're still calling it different things. They haven't agreed on a common term.
Yeah.
Some scientists are calling this the noetic sciences people are calling it the field.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Hawking calls it the mind of God.
Mm-hmm.
Former astronaut Edgar Mitchell called it nature's mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's being called the divine matrix is the name that I'm using in the book. In 1944, the father of quantum physics, Max Planck, mm-hmm. he said this field is out there. He said underlying all matter is the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. He said this mind is the matrix of all matter, and that was a very, very powerful thing for him to have said back in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
So this field, it is the quantum energetic potential. It's the soup that precedes everything in our lives. The way that things get to be from that soup to the reality of our world is through the way that we use and focus our individualized consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So what the studies are showing, what the research shows, and what the ancient texts say, is that you and me and our listeners, everyone who's ever existed, in our mind, we can imagine any possibility, and it is only a possibility. It's only a potential, or in the language that you were just asking me, it is a scalar quantity of energy. In our imagination, once we breathe life into our imagination through the power of emotion, and this is the great secret that was lost in the text 1700 years ago, once we create the feeling of our love or our fear for what it is that we've imagined in our lives, we take that possibility from the waveform into the particle form, or from the scalar form into the vector form, or in everyday language, we take it from imagination into what becomes real in our lives,
mm-hmm.
and we do it with the healing in our bodies, we do it with the peace between nations, and we do it all the time. We may not always be aware of what and how we're doing these things. And this is the essence of these most, the most sacred teachings are taking this internal technology of transforming imagination into reality,
mm-hmm.
And taking that out of the realm of esoteric tradition and bringing it into something that is useful in our lives. It's all happening within the realm of consciousness. Consciousness is both the energetic as well as the particle representation. Consciousness is both the scalar and the vector. It's both the imagined and the real. It all is happening within this broad envelope that we call consciousness. And within consciousness, there are the individualized expressions. Some of them are invisible matter, some of them are visible particles. And they can move back and forth. This is what quantum physicists are finding, that matter is not locked in to being matter. Matter can become invisible energy, or it can be visible matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that the way we feel about our world plays a huge role in how that happens. And this again is one of the great secrets of the ancients, of how we go about honing our inner life experience to become the world around us.
Well, I want to ask you, you said something that made me start off wanting to ask you my first question of this series. But
sure.
Before we do that, I want to ask you, I've been working with two scientists that everybody would know. I'm not going to say their names because there's a little bit of conflict going on with an opinion they both have right now. So I want to ask you your opinion about it. They were having a discussion about praying for peace for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And one scientist said, oh, no, you can't pray for peace for Israel. And the other scientist said, oh, yes, I can. I can pray for peace for Israel. And I happen to agree with the first one. You can't just pray for peace for Israel because, you know, if you're familiar with David Hawkins' work, you know, in those gradients of consciousness there, you're going to have those people that reside under 200 that's going to... Are you familiar with that work?
I'm not familiar with... I haven't been drawn to David Hawkins' work, to be honest.
Oh, you got to read that. It's called Power versus Force.
I'm familiar with the book, but are you familiar with the most recent book that we have out? It's called The Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer. Are you familiar with that?
Is that the little small book?
It is.
I have it, but I hadn't been able to get
it. Okay, well, it's the answer to the question that you're asking now. And And so the reason, and that's why I wanted to talk about this field first, and here's the reason why. This field of energy that is holographic, as you just mentioned, it is also what's called non-local, and if you talk to Russell Targ, I know that he brought up non-locality.
Yeah, I interviewed him too.
Okay, so it's a non-local holographic field. This field plays three roles in our world. Number one, this field literally is the container that holds everything in creation. This is, if you ever wondered what it is that's holding the universe, this field is literally the vessel that holds, we don't know what shape it is, but this field is the field that holds the vessel, number one. Number two, this field is a bridge between what happens in our thoughts, feelings, emotions, beliefs, and prayers inside of our bodies,
mm-hmm.
and what happens in the world around our bodies in response to our prayers. And number three, this field is a mirror, and this is a very, very important part of our conversation. It's a neutral mirror. It's not biased in terms of right, wrong, good, or bad, but this neutral mirror will literally mirror back into our lives, personally and collectively, in our families, in our workplace, our community between nations. It mirrors what we hold to be true in our beliefs, our judgments, our anger, our fear, our love, our compassion, our forgiveness, all of those qualities that are creating this quantum soup and taking things from that quantum soup, bringing it into the reality of our world. These are the emotions that are making that reality. So when you pray for something, and language is very important here.
Exactly.
If you pray for, and I can share a story with you that I share in the book. One of my Native American friends taught me this in a very, very potent way. The moment we pray for something to happen, we just acknowledge that it's not there. And the field will simply acknowledge, the field will mirror back to us the not being there that we just declared. When you say, dear God, please let there be healing in this body, or let there be peace in this world, what you're saying is it's not there right now. And the field will simply mirror that not there to you again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
The field is literal. What it does is it will mirror what is. So if we can feel the feeling as if peace has already occurred in Israel, or the healing has already occurred in our bodies, that's the language that the field recognizes, and it will mirror back every time. And that's precisely what,
mm-hmm.
what we've got video showing this. We've got scientific documentation. It's the the crux of all the programs that we do in the live presentations. It's the crux of that little book that was just released in January of this year.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you that's relative to that is the position that I took on the argument that these two people were having was, we're right, we cannot just pray for peace for Israel, because people will have to insert certain intentions of, let's have peace in Israel by blowing up Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So that will happen. What we finally agreed upon is simply pray for highest good and world peace. Because it makes a difference when you add in those two extra words or thoughts. Do you agree?
If our conversation that we just had has any relevance at all that we're talking about here, whether you're talking about healing in the body or peace, and I know it's well intentioned. If you really want results, this is what researchers are calling a lost modality of prayer. What we know is 1,700 years ago, tremendous amounts of information were edited from both the Jewish and the Christian
mm-hmm.
traditions, and we know it because it was recovered in the 20th century. And
mm-hmm.
among the things that was recovered was the actual language that describes the kind of things that we're talking about now. And while it might seem like it's semantics, it really is the key, because what we found, what scientists now are finding, at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, what they're finding is it's the quality of what's happening inside of us while we're observing matter that is affecting the matter.
That's right.
So with those things in mind, if we are praying for anything, even though I know it's well-intentioned, I know where it's coming from, but the moment we ask for something to happen, we're actually empowering the very condition that we'd like to change. And it's not about peace in any one place. It's about peace in general.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to share a brief story from a Native American friend of mine, and then I'm going to share with you, if it's okay, Eva.
Sure.
What happened in 1998 when a number of researchers working with the Global Consciousness Project and Dean Radin and Roger Nelson's project, and I think it might help to illustrate this point, that the story that I tell in the book, and the one that that really helps to understand this very subtle yet very powerful concept. I live in the high deserts in northern New Mexico. In the early 1990s, it was one of the worst droughts in the history of this part of the world in over 400 years. So dry that the Rio Grande River actually dried up in northern New Mexico, and the headwaters began just outside of Taos, New Mexico. And a friend of mine from one of the native communities called and asked if I would like to go to him with him and pray rain at the place where his ancestors have done this for hundreds of years. And he didn't have to ask me twice. I said, sure. So we found ourselves at this in the middle of hundreds of thousands of acres of beautiful high-altitude desert sage and an ancient stone circle that was so old he didn't even know who put it there. My friend's name, I'll just call him David, to protect his anonymity. And what I saw, I wasn't prepared for what I saw as an Anglo. I had an expectation. I thought I was going to see some chanting and some dancing. And what I saw was David simply, he took off his old work boots. He put his bare feet in this stone circle. He held his hands in a prayer mudra in front of his heart, turned his back to me and faced the sun. He honored all of his ancestors. And about 20 seconds later, he closed his eyes and he just turned around and looked at me and said, I'm hungry. You want to go get a bite to eat? And I looked at him and I said, well, sure, you know, I'd like to get a bite to eat, but I thought you were going to pray for rain. I thought we came here to pray for rain. And he said, no. And this is the key. He looked me in the eye and he said, if I prayed for rain could never happen. Because the minute you pray for something to occur, you've just acknowledged that it doesn't exist, and you may have empowered the very thing that you'd like to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, if you didn't pray for rain, what did you do? Why don't you close your eyes? And this is the key. He says, when I closed my eyes, I felt the feeling of what it feels like to stand with my feet in the mud in our Pueblo village, and the mud is there because there's been so much rain. And I smelled the smells of what it smells like when the rain falls off the earthen walls of our Pueblo village. And he said, and what he was doing, he was engaging all of his senses, and this is what was lost.
So in, what happened?
In our modalities of prayer. Well, we had lunch that day.
And
by the time I got back up on my property in northern New Mexico, we saw something we hadn't seen for months, or big black clouds over the Sangre de Cristo Mountains to the east. By the time the sun went down, it started to rain, and it rained all that night. It rained the next morning. It rained in the mid-afternoon. And even it rained so much, and the ground was so dry, it couldn't soak it up, and it began to flood. Cattle were stranded, and roads were washed out, and there were mudslides. And I called David on the phone. And I said, David, what in the world's going on? This is a mess. I said, this is really bad. And he was silent just for a minute. And he said, that's the part of the prayer that the ancestors could never figure out. It's like they could get it started, but they couldn't tell it how much to rain.
He needed to feel it in a certain manner. He left that part out.
But yes, and the reason I share the story, it was two reasons. First of all, I cannot prove scientifically that David's prayer had anything to do with that rain. What I can say is the correlation is high
mm-hmm.
between the time the rain happened and when that prayer. I watched the weather maps from our satellite. I could pick up Denver, Colorado, and the weather map showed the jet stream coming across Utah and Idaho, Utah into Wyoming, and then it made a big dip, like a big U-turn down. Past Colorado, northern New Mexico, made a little U-turn and went right back up. And I remember the weatherman looked at it and he just said, huh. That was all he said. He'd never seen anything like that. Now, you can't prove that scientifically, but this is the way Native traditions have accomplished healing
mm-hmm.
as well as provided for their people in times of need. And the secret is that they know how to communicate with this quantum field in a language that the field recognizes. And the field doesn't necessarily recognize our verbal commands.
Mm-hmm.
The field recognizes the power of human emotion generated in the heart through what is called coherent heart-based emotions.
HeartMath's doing a lot of work with that right now.
Well, I'm very good friends. I've been with them since 91, and Deb Rosman and many of the folks out there.
I work with Roland.
Okay,
Roland?
Well, Roland McCready, Glenn Ryan, we've had many, Howard Martin, we've had many conversations about this. And this is a long answer to the short question that you asked me, because unless we are addressing our unity, the connectedness that we have, there is no them and us from the perspective of this field.
Mm-hmm.
There is no them in the Middle East and us here. There is a we, and we are part of everything that's happening in our world today, although we may not always be conscious of how we are participating.
That's right.
And as we can become conscious of the dynamics and the mechanism of how this field works, it's just mirroring back the language that we give it to work with, and the language that was lost 1,700 years ago in the biblical edits of the 4th century and in the Hebrew edits as well,
mm-hmm.
is the language of emotion. Feel the feeling as if your prayer has already been answered, as if the healing has already happened, as if the abundance is already there, as if the peace has already happened, so that the field has something to work with and can mirror that back to us. Now, we've seen this. Eva, many of your listeners may have been to some of the live programs. We do every 2 weeks. We're doing these somewhere in the world. And
are
many
you coming
of them right
to Atlanta
here.
Anytime?
Pardon me?
You going to come to Atlanta anytime?
We're just in Atlanta. We won't. I don't have anything scheduled for the rest of 06 or 07 right now. I'll tell you, I'll be in Orlando. We'll be the closest I'll be to you. It's on our website.
You know, one of the problems, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
yeah, sure.
It's at a good point. One of the problems with people believing this, you know, the fundamental average person walking around, is because they don't have good clinical trials, like the clinical trial at Harvard over peace, and I mean prayer for healing. You can't control consciousness in clinical trials. It's like you couldn't control that rain.
Well, what happened
so
in those?
Why they don't believe it.
Those Harvard studies, they were using an outmoded type of prayer. They were using the mode of prayer that says we're separate from our world. that we are powerless to do anything in our world, so we ask for help from a higher power.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of prayer they were using. I'm not surprised that they didn't have much effect.
Yeah.
This modality of prayer, this is the prayer. Think about it, Eve. What would be so powerful that it had to be taken out of our most cherished text 1,700 years ago, and that the actual instructions that tell us how to do this would be kept in the Vatican libraries until early in the 20th century? What could possibly, I mean, what could have happened 1,700 years ago that would have any effect whatsoever on our highly technological, sophisticated microchip world? Why would we care what was in those texts?
Well, I'll tell you something. I live next door to an Orthodox synagogue,
mm-hmm.
and I grew up a Baptist, but then I later converted to a conservative Jew just for marital purposes. But I don't know if you know about me, but I had a spiritual epiphany, and when I woke up, I had an amazing gift of medical intuition. And I also get a lot about quantum mechanics, and I'd never heard of any of this stuff before.
Sure.
So I went next door. You know, I was trying to get people to listen to me because I found out that it worked. And I went to this rabbi over here, and I started telling him about it, and he wouldn't even talk to me at first. And finally I said, "Rabbi, how can you really live with yourself and tell me that I'm of the devil if you don't even know what I have to say? You know, let me show you, and then let's talk about it." So we did it, and when it was over, he said, "Well, you obviously are trying to use it in the right way, and I'll tell you something. Thousands of years ago, the rabbis realized that the power of intention was the most powerful thing of all, because they realized that we are God."
Mm-hmm.
So they took that text out of the writings of the Torah and of the, what is the other word? I can't think of the other thing they call it. But they took the writings out because people were using it to hurt people. And now they're scared to put it back in because they know that people will use it the wrong way and hurt each other. So they know that it's there, and they know that it's real.
Sure. Well, the little book, Western prayer researchers today acknowledge four modes of prayer they say that we use. And there's no wrong way to pray. They're all good. We all use them from time to time. They all have their place. They all have a purpose. And there's always been reference to another mode that simply didn't fit those four categories. When you read, you know, you're in the Tibetan monasteries, or you're in the native traditions, or you're reading the temple walls, there's always been reference to another mode. And this is the fifth mode, or the lost mode, of prayer. And it's a prayer that has no words, no outward expression. It's a prayer based in feeling, heart-based, coherent emotions of feeling. And it's feeling as if your prayer has already been answered, as if it's already come to pass.
That's right.
And this is, when you get a chance, the little book, Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, it's doing really well right now, because I think it really has hit a chord of truth with people that either have suspected this or else have done it all their lives and didn't know exactly why they were doing what they were doing. But in our live programs, Eva, we have a video where we can actually see inside the body of a living woman through ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a woman who's been diagnosed by Western scientists as having an inoperable cancer in her bladder. And she's gone to an Eastern clinic where they're using traditions that are based on what we're talking about right now, where those practitioners are trained to feel. They're not angry at the cancer. They're not trying to make it go away. They're not trying to irradiate it or cut it out. What they acknowledge is that cancer is one possibility. It's one expression, one quantum expression out of all the others that are there. Just like my friend David said that the drought is one possibility. He wasn't angry at it. He didn't want to make the drought go away. He actually blessed the drought. He blessed what has been up until that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then what these practitioners do is, using the techniques that we talk about in the books, in the programs that were in these lost texts, ancient temples, they feel the feeling as if this woman were fully healed, fully capacitated, fully enabled. They're not judging the present condition. They're choosing a new one through the way that they feel. And in less than 3 minutes, it's in 2 minutes and 40 seconds in real time, we can literally see that condition disappear in this woman's body.
Are you serious?
And we show these all the time. And they do these kinds of things all the time in other parts of the world because their belief system allows for it. Now, when I show it to medical practitioners, I was just with the Air Force medical folks down in San Antonio, Texas, for 3 days and shared it with them. And I've shared it with medical doctors all over the country. They agree that it's miraculous. However, there's a huge disconnect because we're taught to believe that we have no effect on the world around us and that there's nothing that connects our hearts and our beliefs with the physical reality.
Mm-hmm.
So to us, it doesn't make sense. And that's why we're doing the work and writing the books. There'll be you'll see some television specials based on this work coming up this next year. Because this field is so real that it literally mirrors in 2 or 3 minutes, if we have the quality of the language, it'll change our reality. Now, that's with one woman. Now, we did the same thing. In 1998, we worked with Dean Radin, Roger Nelson, Princeton University, when he was there. He's no longer with Princeton now. He's working with Noetic Sciences. And we organized several hundred thousand people throughout the world, and we sent them the instructions on the internet, how to feel the feeling as if peace has already happened in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And at a chosen hour in time, this was coordinated, and we don't really know how many people participated, because for every one internet connection, there could be hundreds of people. For example, in Japan, they had one live feed into an auditorium, and they had 400 people in that auditorium, but it showed up as one hit on the internet.
Right.
But what happened during that hour was that in major cities, and they could document this, emergency hospital room visits declined and traffic accidents declined. What was really interesting to me was that, and we didn't know this, but then President Bill Clinton had ordered an airstrike into Iraq during the no-fly zone days when Saddam Hussein was still in power.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had no way of knowing anything about that. The next morning in the newspapers, L.A. Times and Wall Street Journal, front page, they had big headlines saying how this airstrike had been ordered and been given a rare order to stand down. They literally turned around and came home. And no one could figure out, it didn't make any sense, because they've been ordered to go. And all that we know is this, is that in the presence of peace, and we weren't praying for no airstrikes in Iraq or peace in Jerusalem or peace in our own backyard. We were simply feeling the feelings of peace. And it appears that in the presence of peace, all that can happen is peace. And then people stop the prayer and all those things reversed. So the answer to what your question you asked me probably 10 or 15 minutes ago is I believe it's impossible to pray for peace effectively in a given time and location.
Mm-hmm.
Up through the field, we're all connected. And as we simply pray peace, as we become that peace is registered everywhere because we are holographic, because we are entangled, because we are non-local. And the effect is felt everywhere, and we've got very good documentation showing how that works. So I think it's our ego sometimes that wants to believe that we can make the world change at a certain place and time.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can let that go, even though I'm not saying it's all done consciously, but if we can let it go and simply become that peace in our lives, the field has to mirror peace back to us.
Yeah, something happens with that.
And this is what people say. They say, well, that's too easy. And I say, why would it be any more difficult than that? I believe that we live in a world that mirrors the reality that we choose to invite into our world. And this is the language. The power of human emotion and feeling is the language that we use to invite abundance into our lives and healthy relationships. Good careers and peace between nations and healing in our bodies.
Well, we've got about 15 minutes. I had no idea we would get such an interesting conversation off on that. Well,
I knew
I'd
we
like
would because you and I are talking about consciousness tonight. Either it had to be interesting.
What I'd like to do is go ahead and ask you these questions that I want to ask you for this project.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish you would come back. You know, I stay booked up pretty much in advance. I'm going into March now. But I wish you would come back and let's spend the whole hour on this.
Well, Eva, you, we don't have to have a book or any kind of a book tour going on to have a conversation like this.
That's
if you call
right. I mean,
the office.
I my radio show stays booked up. That's what I mean.
Well, we do too. We're usually booked about a year in advance. Call our office and just let them know when you'd like to have another conversation.
Yeah, I think
and
this would make a good another good conversation.
Well,
we didn't get into near enough, I don't think. There's so much more.
Well, before you ask that question, now that we've talked about this field and the fact that it mirrors what we believe to be true about ourselves, this is the reason, the very first question you asked, the reason the God code is so important. Because the God code tells us that we are literally God eternal within the body. We're part of one another, and we're part of a greater presence. And as we begin to really anchor that into our beliefs, then I full well expect that the field will mirror that back to us in very life-affirming ways of peace and healing, rather than helping us to feel separate from God, separate from one another, and powerless in our world. So that's where those two projects dovetail together, and then I'm going to let you ask that question.
Yeah, I'd really like to get into that with you some more.
All right.
I really would.
All right.
On these other questions, what I'm going to do is, when I get through with this project, I'm going to transcribe all of these things, and we're going to have a panel, hopefully, at Iceme this June, and put it all out there.
Mm. Well, thank you for the work you're doing right now. I'm going to say that before we run out of time tonight,
and
for being such a gracious host. I appreciate it.
It gets hard sometimes because people don't want to hear it. But,
sure.
But it's the only thing I know to do. Anyway, what is your definition of consciousness?
Well, I think we just heard it over the last 45 minutes.
From my
perspective, consciousness is everything that exists, all part of consciousness. It is both the seen and the unseen. It is the wave and the particle expression of energy in our universe. It's the scalar and the vector.
Mm-hmm.
And we are individualized pieces of that consciousness that are creating the reality of our world by converting our imagination of the wave form of energy into the particle, the visible form of energy, and it all is happening within the great umbrella of what I would call consciousness.
And I just want to make this clear. You don't think that it stops with the quantum unit, do you?
Absolutely not.
Okay, good.
Because the quantum unit, by all appearances, appears it's not the smallest unit
of
matter.
It's not the irreducible. It sits on the field. The field feeds it whatever the force it is that moves it and makes it shake, rattle, and roll
and
happen.
It's true, yes, Eva. And I don't know if you had the opportunity to interview Professor John Wheeler from Princeton University, was a colleague of Einstein's.
Yet,
he's still with us today. But from his perspective, what he suggests is that things are what they are because consciousness is an act of creation unto itself. In other words, everywhere we look, consciousness puts something there for us to see.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at the smaller and smaller particles of energy in creation, we may never find. Now this is me extrapolating on what John Wheeler has said. We may never find that smallest particle because no matter how finely we divide those units of existence, the units of what everything is made of, the act of us looking for something will put another something there for us to
That's
see.
That's right. There's going to be something else to see.
Yeah. And for the same reason, we'll probably never find the edge of the universe because we can build the strongest radio telescopes imaginable, and the act of us looking to the edges of creation with the expectation that something is there, that expectation, consciousness will put something there for us to see.
I wrote in my book, the universe is as big as you think it is. You know?
Can I quote you on that?
Yep.
Okay.
In my book. You know, it's the biggest telescope you can find to look at something, it'll be there because you think it's supposed to be there.
Well, this is the essence, and I can imagine all of your conversations, whether it's Russell Targ or Dean Radin or Nick Herbert or many of the people that you mentioned you've interviewed, they're all touching on this in one way or another from their unique perspectives.
Okay, next question. What is your definition of mind?
Mind is the individualized experience within the field of consciousness.
All right, how would that apply to mass consciousness mind?
Mass consciousness mind would be, a lot of this is semantics, and it's because...
I know, we got a language problem.
Well, it's because we are exploring an experience that we really don't have the language to explore. So we're approximating. It is our collective minds merged together into a greater subunit of consciousness.
Pulling this out, but you make it so interesting. I've actually got a linguist named Matthew Bronson at California Integral Institute that is going to help us once we get the gradients identified. He's going to help us come up with words or groups of words so at least we can all sit down at the table and talk about the same thing.
We can, Eva, and it's so abstract. I mean, while mind, my understanding, my belief is mind is an individualized, discrete unit in consciousness. If you were to ask me where mind ends and where consciousness begins, I couldn't draw that line.
Yeah, I don't think I could either.
So they're abstract concepts to help us feel comfortable in what we're talking about. And I think the whole key is as long as we keep separating ourselves from consciousness, we're going to feel powerless to do anything about what's happening in our world.
People need to really accept that the world is really non-dual.
Well, that is the essence of the book Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, the new book, The Divine Matrix, that will be out later this year. And I think that is one of the great secrets in a different language that the ancients were telling us. They weren't telling us in the language of the technical language of today. They were just using it in parables, but this is what they were saying.
They could, yeah. Okay, next question. Do you think that the brain thinks? Or, you know, in other words, what is the source of creation? Well, I believe the source of creativity and intentionality is mind with a capital M, or source, or consciousness.
Well, I can answer the question, but it'll probably lead to more questions. The answer to the question is no, I don't think that the brain thinks.
Okay, I think that it interprets.
Well, because I believe the evidence strongly suggests we don't even hold memories in our brains, that our brains are the neural circuits, or the antenna, if you will, that tune us to the place in the field where that information resides, and that's why there really are no secrets. Everyone has access to everyone else's information, maybe not always consciously, but it's all out there. So when we are growing new neural circuits, or we say that we're remembering, what we're doing is we're growing the antenna that tunes us into the place in the field of consciousness where that information already exists.
I have a comment on that if we have time. My next question is, the information from consciousness and mind have to be interpreted by the brain somehow in order for us to use it and function with it. Do you think that information is interpreted by frequencies like the Morse code, electromagnetic impulse or magnetic electro impulses, you know, like space, space, dot, dot, space may mean... let's go to the park today, or space, space, dot, space, space might mean you're going to get kidney disease.
Sure, the answer is yes. I believe it is a, it's based in light. Light is the language, and our brain is essentially a transducer.
Mm-hmm.
Once we tune to the light, if you will, or the information, then our brain is the transducer that changes that frequency into... and Carl Pribram talked about this a lot with his concept of a holographic brain, and David Bohm with the holographic universe. They both came up with the ideas about the same point in time. We live in a holographic universe. Our brains are holographic, tuning into that holographic universe. The neural circuits tune to the information or the light in a point in space and time, and our brains are the transducers that take that information and convert it to an experience that we can relate to.
And my next question is, this one I just want you to say yes or no, because I know we can get into another 30-minute conversation here. Do you think that there are gradients of consciousness?
No.
Do you know what I mean by that?
No. No, the answer is...
I wish you would read that Power versus Force book. But basically what it is there are people in the world like the fundamentalists that Hawkins scale is like 0 to 100, 101 to 200, you know, on up to 1,000. And when you get to 500, something happens, and most people in the world don't get there. And it's not good or bad. It's just like age experience of the soul. So that, let's just say that to get there to that 500 is usually because somebody's had a spiritual epiphany. So somehow that has to happen. So I'm wondering if the higher your electromagnetic field vibrates, you know, the faster the speed, because we know the faster something vibrates, the less dense it is. Would it be like possibly when you get to like 500, and that's just a fictitious scale, but when you get to that, maybe that takes you up to 500,000 hertz, and maybe it's like unlocking a key, and suddenly you have knowledge that's been sitting there waiting on you all along.
Okay.
It's always accessible, but only when you're ready to hear it.
Well, that's a different question. The question you asked, if I thought there were gradients in consciousness, I believe that the information is already there. It's out there, and there are no gradients in the consciousness itself. And what you're talking about is
our individual consciousness,
is our ability to find that information, to tune to that. I believe that through the choices that we make in our lives, we're given a certain level of awareness that gets us going in life, and we can live our whole lives and never change that, and we're just fine. And that through some life experiences, we have the opportunity to change ourselves, and as we do, it allows us to tune into more and more of that field that's already out there. I think that's what's happening.
Okay.
Was that beep for us?
I don't know what that beep was.
I thought that was a beep telling me it's all that the program's finished.
I don't know what that was. I've never heard that before. Maybe it was a synchronistic event telling us we were hitting on something important.
Maybe.
Don't know. I don't know what that was.
Yeah.
And
you're right, Eva. I mean, Eva, that's a whole conversation that we could have to really clarify what that is. But then the one answer to that single sentence, that would be the way I'd
write. Well, the gradients are, you know, I had one yesterday. A woman read my book, and she was like, oh, my God, this is a great book. Until it got to the point, she was a fundamental Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
When it got to the point where I said God's not a man sitting on a throne,
mm-hmm.
and that there's no burning hell with a devil with horns in it, she had a problem. I don't know what that is. It did it again.
Well, we're both hearing it, so that's good. It means it's not ringing in my ears. My experience, Eve, and I've done this, again, this is the 20th year we've offered this in one form or another, is that it's impossible to convince or persuade another person of a belief system or of our belief in a belief system. All that we can do is share in a kind way, without judgment, what it is we've found to be true in our lives. As a scientist, I've found that, and in my personal life, as I've married science and spirituality, the way to honor the people I love is to simply share with them and demonstrate through the way I live my life what I found to be true. And what happens is they pick up on subtle cues, but because they don't feel that they're being persuaded, they won't resist. If they feel that there's an attempt to persuade or convince them, that typically is where the resistance comes in.
Yeah, they're going to get defensive. I said to the woman, she said, well, I think that your information is great, but I think that you're being led by an evil source. And I said, well, you know what? If that's true, maybe I am, but that evil source directed me to do everything I could to be the biggest proponent for peace in the world that I knew how to be. So if that's true, I'm all for it. Anyway, the show's over. If you had 1 minute, I mean, if you could say one thing to the world that you thought could or would make a difference, what would that be?
It won't even take me a minute to do it. I'll say that the science has shown us, and the ancients tell us, that the world around us is nothing more and nothing less than a mirror of what we have created and our beliefs, our thoughts, feelings, emotions, prayers, and judgments. And if we'd like to see the change in the world, we've got to live and become the very things that we would like to experience in our lives.
Thank you, Greg Braden. Agape.
Thank you. God bless. Thank you for being such a gracious host, Eva. Take good care.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.